Welcome to Explore the Space. We're digging into healthcare issues that matter most. Our guests and conversations mine these issues for perspective and answers. There is a gulf between healthcare and our communities. This is the place to talk about it. Now here's your host, Dr. Mark Shapiro.
Welcome to Explore the Space. I am very excited about this interview.
I would like to welcome my colleague and friend, Guy Bezek. Guy's an emergency physician in San Diego, and he's here to talk to us because he has been on a very rare and challenging adventure. And when I say rare, I mean rare for really anyone across the human experience. Guy just got back from a medical aid trip to Sierra Leone, working with patients, families, and the whole community there that have been battling Ebola. So Guy, thank you very much for coming and welcome.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate the invitation. It's awesome to be here with you.
So this is a huge topic. Obviously, it dominated the headlines around the world for the better part of 2014 and part of 2015. It's an incredibly compelling story, and I want to hear all about it, and I want our listeners to hear all of the things that you went through and that you saw and experienced. Let's start at the beginning, though. What was sort of the genesis of you getting involved in this and actually getting on a plane and flying to West Africa?
Well, if you remember back at the time when the media was going somewhat hysterical and the public was quite hysterical as well, there was a big push from a lot of the NGOs at that time, and they went through USAID to really get the word out that medical volunteers were needed. And it was, at that time, it was, we need people on the ground. We just need someone who knows how to start an IV. We need someone who knows how to, you know, dose a medication. So it's very simple medical care. They just needed people. And so at that time, I just applied through the USAID website and got hooked up with Partners in Health, which is an NGO out of Boston led by Paul Farmer. And they've done extensive work in Haiti. And I ended up getting hooked into their organization, training with them in Boston.
What time of year was this?
So I applied probably in, must have been September or October. Okay. And then I ended up going with them at the very beginning of January.
So January of 2015.
January 2015.
So this isn't just, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to apply for a membership to a society. This is a personal journey to say, I'm going to leave my colleagues, I'm going to leave my family, I'm going to leave everything I kind of know behind. Take us through the sort of mental gymnastics and that process of saying, this is important enough for me to leave all of these people behind and kind of put myself in harm's way, in a manner of speaking. What was that sort of mental journey like? What even prompted you to flip the switch to start this process?
I think, yeah, everyone's going to have a different answer to that. But I know for me and most people I've met, there was such a compelling need that I have never witnessed in my lifetime. And I think very few people have ever witnessed the compelling need at that specific moment in time. And so, it was just the need of controlling this outbreak. And there was a humanitarian aspect to it, that people are dying and nobody's caring for them. And they're in the streets and their children and women, and just a brutal disease, and we should do something about it. But then there was also the global aspect, like we need to control this outbreak, otherwise it's going to be a threat to Sierra Leone's economy, to Liberia, to Guinea, but also to all of Africa, and then eventually to possibly the United States. And you know, so there's so many different motivations, but balancing those against the personal aspects was extremely difficult because, yeah, no matter how big your goal or how lofty the principle, personal relationships always trump that. And personal relationships, that's the most important thing.
Yeah.
And so it was just kind of working through what it would do to everybody, but fortunately I had, very supportive family and life.
So when you left San Diego, did you feel like it was larger than you in a way? Were there more people pegging their sort of same level of interest and engagement to you because you were the one that was leaving? Or did you feel like, hey, I'm on this adventure by myself?
It was mixed because, there was some support and there was some resistance from everyone, from colleagues and from family and friends too. So there was no, it wasn't easy.
Uh-huh.
it wasn't easy to leave. People have become more, well, personally, but even from a public standpoint, people have become more and more supportive, I think, of the cause now, but that That's wasn't necessarily the case 6 months ago, 4 months ago.
Because you were starting this process early on. You were doing this at the peak of when every headline, every news crawler, everything is Ebola and what's happening. So you were right, you were leaving right in the thick of it. So before we had ramped up probably a lot of relief efforts and things like that.
The people that were really there at the hard time, I mean, that's when it started, was, you know, when the real big, you know, exponential increase kicked in June and July. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are the people that were really there when nothing was in place. Mm-hmm. By the time I got there, things were in place. But I mean, that the people who were there early on just went through just unbelievable difficulties and challenges.
When you left to go to West Africa, I can't imagine it was a seamless, easy, just like, you know, fly to Heathrow or something like that. There must have been a bunch of hurdles to go through.
We're not talking about coming back in, because that's a different story.
Fair enough.
But going out, you know, we logistically was a trip to Boston.
Okay.
And some training in Boston, and then flying from Boston through Brussels. And then Brussels Air is one of the few airlines that's serving West Africa still. And, you know, I think they've kept those flights open mostly for humanitarian purposes, because you have tons of people going in and out of those three countries right now that are just related to the aid effort.
Wow.
So you have entire flights full of Ebola responders, epidemiologists, CDC, WHO, the UN, the African Union, and so you'll be on a plane. So I went from Brussels down to Senegal, from Senegal to Conakry, Guinea, and from Guinea to Sierra Leone eventually. So it is a roundabout way. You don't have any direct flights Freetown from San Diego.
When you're traveling, you're obviously never really by yourself. Are you kind of always in a kind of a community of like-minded people who are heading there for the same reasons?
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely different than other things I've been involved with internationally. I mean, there's very strong organizations that, you know, like Partners in Health and MSF that are organizing this. And so, you know, there's a lot of pressure taken off you for those logistics. Mm-hmm. They've got it figured out. They've got it dialed in, how to get you to the place where you need to be, set you up in, you know, some type of lodging, mm-hmm. whether it's a hotel or a tent. And so the logistics are now in place. Mm-hmm. But again, 6 months ago, those logistics weren't really in place.
Yeah. So when you were in the training portion, that was mostly learning how to, you know, the phrase that we use is the donning and doffing, the putting on and removing of personal protective equipment, PPE. People have probably heard that in the press or seen it on CNN. The yellow suits with the mask and the total body coverage. Was a lot of the training around how to take care of yourself? What other things were going on in your training?
Yeah, so the training is, you know, it's fairly extensive. Most of the group that I went with, our goal was predominantly patient care.
Okay.
And so it did center a lot on protecting yourself. So PPE, personal protective equipment, and how to don and how to doff. Mm-hmm. And the WHO gave us a 3-day training in Freetown.
Okay.
And they were assisted by the Sierra Leonean military. And they did a great job just sort of showing us how to be safe. And that's, you know, that is the number one priority in that environment. You cannot afford to get sick, not because you're going to get sick and you might die, but because that hinders the operation. I mean, that can take all the attention away from the patients and away from the public health message to potentially millions of dollars of resources into a sick healthcare worker from the U.S. Nobody wants that.
It's amazing to think about it. I remember when I was an intern and, you know, retired, whatever, haven't slept much, haven't really eaten, and I was fatigued. And one of the residents said to me, listen, you have to take care of yourself before you can take care of other people. And I never forgot that message. And as I'm hearing what you're talking, it's just that on a scale, I can't comprehend that scale. So did you have a sense of the size of what you had to do? It was like, hey, I'm ready. Let's just get going. It's just hard to wrap the mind around that for me. I have to be totally honest with you. And give me a sense of what it's like when you're in Freetown. You've got all the support around you, and now you're kind of getting ready to deploy, kind of getting your mind right. How does that work?
Well, really, by that point, you've been through so much training.
Okay.
You're just ready to dig in.
Okay.
Because, you know, you've been waiting for weeks and weeks back in the States.
Okay.
And you're going through some training in Boston. You're going over and you're in Sierra Leone and you've learned and you've sat in lectures and you've okay. practiced.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like anything. You know, in medicine, you go through medical school and the first 2 years are all lectures.
Right.
And you're ready for third year.
You're just ready to
get into the clinic and do some real medicine.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of thing. And if, of course, it's tempered by a safety factor, but you know, you've already fought that in your mind.
Gotcha.
I think it's only when you get into the environment and into the Ebola treatment center and you see a patient and you touch a patient and you know you're potentially
there.
Being exposed, that's when you start to understand the fear and how serious it really is.
Yeah. How many hours of practice did you have? I mean, how long? I want to get a sense of, we're not sending dilettantes to Sierra Leone. I mean, you were well drilled in the steps of the donning and doffing PPE. I mean, how many hours of training would you say you put in? So people have a sense of, you know, you're as ready as you can be to take the field, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, I mean, it's balanced because you can't train forever. And really, ideally, you would do hundreds of dry runs of donning and doffing PPE. But, you know, it was probably a full week of education and the drills. So, you know, 50, 60 hours of that, plus being mentored when you went into the hot zone. So you didn't just get let loose into the hot zone. Uh-huh. They have systems in place.
Okay. So now we're in, you're there, you've got your accommodation set up. You have a team that you're working with?
Yeah, so from my specific experience, you know, I did a couple different things. I went to Kono, which is a district in Sierra Leone.
Okay.
It's the big diamond mining district, and one of the biggest diamond mines in Africa is there.
Mm-hmm.
And there we worked at community care centers, which are essentially small Ebola treatment centers.
Okay.
But their job is to triage patients and then to refer those that are positive to treatment centers.
Okay.
And so for 2 weeks I was there and working actually closely with the community and the Sierra Leoneans.
Okay.
Because a big part of Partners in Health and their process is what they call, and what anyone would call accompaniment, being with the local people that you are trying to support. And so we worked with the local people very closely.
Was that your first assignment?
That was the first assignment.
Okay.
And then later on, after a couple of weeks there, I went to Maforki, which is a district just north of Freetown. And it was between Freetown and Port Loko. Those were the two hottest, and still remain the two hottest districts in terms of Ebola cases per day, per week in Sierra Leone. And I worked at Maforki Ebola Treatment Center. And that was with Sierra Leoneans. So we had staff, nurses, cleaners who were Sierra Leonean. And then we had Cubans. So we had some Cubans with us at that time. And then the Partners in Health people.
So then when you're starting off, do they keep you in a kind of a quarantine aside from when you're working? Or are you allowed to mix and mingle as much as you like? How does it work in the sort of day-to-day when you're getting settled, when you're going to bed down for the night, when you're going to
eat,
that sort of a thing?
Well, first off, when you get into the country, it's a different feel because, you're told you can't go to the market.
Okay.
Don't interact with locals, essentially.
Wow.
3 foot distance, so you always maintain personal space of 3 foot from everybody. In all honesty, it's never practiced.
It's hard to do.
This is sort of the ideal.
Okay.
And, you know, then
no
you
hand
shake
shaking.
Hands.
Yeah.
Yeah. You sort of touch your chest and introduce yourself.
Okay.
If you want to be particularly gregarious, you can touch elbows with someone.
Okay.
That's sort of the greeting there.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, the whole society, Sierra Leonean society, has changed because, I mean, they're a very gregarious culture, full of hugging and kissing on the cheek.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's been a major shift in their culture. And they just don't do that. And neighbors don't do that to neighbors. And, you know, potentially even in families, you know, cousins are just not as affectionate because they've had to change behaviors.
Did you see resistance to that? I mean, I remember reading articles and hearing sort of stories that there's a lot of resistance to some of these things in these countries. And of course, it's understandable. These are
right.
huge paradigm shifts for the way they've lived their lives. Is that something that you would see, or did you feel like people were trying to adapt to these mechanisms to try to be safe and prevent spread?
Well, I don't think that I saw a lot of resistance, but again, that's with me being somewhat isolated from mm-hmm. the culture itself. But you know there is resistance when you have 10 cases come in over a 1 or 2 day period, and they're all connected, and you know, day or two later you find out, okay, these guys came from an unsafe burial. And that's really where you'd get these surges of cases, mm-hmm. and almost always you could predict that there was an unsafe burial somewhere,
okay.
that the appropriate burial team wasn't called. And most of those patients, yeah, would die because they're exposed to such a high level of virus, because you're dealing with a dead corpse, which is probably the most infectious time and the infectious exposure you can get. So most of those people would generally die.
And this was the ritualized tending of the body, washing the body, hands on the body to lay it to rest, as opposed to, I think the recommendation is cremation now, right?
Well, that was, cremation was tried in Liberia, but that meant extreme resistance, because that's just one of those cultural things. You uh-huh. go into a culture that you don't understand, and you try to dictate what they do with their bodies. And
right.
although that's probably the safest thing, if you try to cremate the dead bodies, well, the local people think that body, that soul, can't pass on into the afterlife.
Yeah.
And so that generates more unsafe burials, because mm-hmm. there's more hiding of the body, because you can't let your father, who just died, he needs to pass to the afterlife.
Yeah.
So you're not going to let these people in white suits take him away and cremate him.
Right.
And so that was, I think a lot of cultural misunderstandings led to a lot of the resistance.
Uh-huh.
So I think it's hard to blame the people. It's hard to blame the culture.
Yeah.
It's a clash of cultures, and a clash of cultures will lead to that kind of resistance.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially in a country, in an area that's just gone through a civil war and mm-hmm. has come out of colonialism only 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And is still probably being exploited for their diamonds and their other natural resources.
Yeah, it's a country that's still trying to establish its own identity.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Here again come, as you say, the people in white suits saying this is what you have to do.
And
that's going to meet with resistance.
In body bags, for a while they used black body bags. Uh-huh. But again, resistance, because you, of course, only wrap the corpse in white sheets.
Oh, my goodness.
So you know, but we adapted. We moved to white body bags.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's little things that can create disease.
Yeah.
You know, ultimately lead to more disease if you don't take into account. So anthropologists are a huge part of any kind of response like this.
Sure. No, that's fascinating, because they can give you some of those insights before you trip over the hurdle. You can clear the hurdle.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's that's just one of the fundamental problems of a bunch of NGOs rushing into an emergency mm-hmm. situation. You want to act fast, and you need to act fast, but you're going to make a lot of mistakes because you don't understand the people.
Yeah.
You don't understand the culture.
So you get there and you're starting off on your first day, and you kind of head out to go to work. Take us through that morning, the first day, the next day, kind of moving forward, just for you, the preparation to go and see patients.
Yeah, let me walk through sort of the average day there. So in Mafourke, we would get there in the morning, and we did 8 hour shifts. And fortunately, we had the staff to cover 24 hours a day. So we had 8 hour shifts over a 24 hour span.
And Mafourke was one of the Ebola treatment
centers. That is the Ebola treatment.
So that's where patients would sort of be centralized.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And so, patients would come via ambulance or walk in, and they would get triaged and go into the unit. You know, Mafourke, the Ebola treatment center, sat just outside of a city, and it's actually an old vocational school that just sort of in the midst of trying to find some place to put all these patients who were dying in you know, July and August, they converted this school into a treatment center. And so it's a bit makeshift.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit rough around the edges, but it works.
Mm-hmm.
And so patients would come in usually by ambulance, because by the time I got there, the 117 system was working. And so the 117 system is essentially a 911 for Ebola, something new to this area. There's no 911 there, but mm-hmm. the part of this response was to establish this phone system. You just call 117 for a dead body you find on the road, for a sick neighbor, for a sick son, or for anything Ebola related. Mm-hmm. And so you'd get an ambulance, and ambulances were in limited supply, and you might have 5 or 6 patients all suspected of Ebola. Jammed in an ambulance coming from 4 hours
oh,
out.
Oh, my gosh.
And some of them would have Ebola. Some of them wouldn't. Some of them might develop it because they were in that ambulance. Ride. You'd open the door and you never knew what you'd find. There'd be sometimes some of the patients would be dead. You'd have a dead 40-year-old and an alive, barely breathing 30-year-old male and, you know, maybe some kids in that ambulance.
And this is you opening the ambulance door.
Yeah,
there's
a triage, and the Sierra Leoneans do a lot of the triage, and we do the triage, and, you know, full PPE, and you take those patients out of the ambulance, and you, as if you were in an ER in the U.S., you would triage them, see what are their symptoms, mm-hmm. do they fit case criteria, and we mm-hmm. had specific case criteria to make mm-hmm. sure, because you don't want to admit people who don't have Ebola to an Ebola treatment center.
Right, right.
It's a scary place, and nosocomial infections happen.
Yeah.
Just like any hospital in the U.S.
So people come in that don't have it, but they get exposed and they get it.
And they may get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and those patients then will go to the suspect ward.
Okay.
And the suspect ward is, cohorted. So you have dry patients and wet patients. The dry patients are those who just have a fever or who are suspected, but they're not having the classic symptoms yet. They're not to the point of diarrhea and vomiting.
Okay.
And so they're not, we presume they're not as infectious.
Okay.
So you cohort those patients because we can't do single room isolation, just don't have the capacity.
Wow.
So you have a group of patients mixing together. And then you have a suspect wet, which is patients you believe to have Ebola,
uh-huh.
you don't know. You don't have the test back, the PCR test, but they're vomiting and diarrhea, so much more infectious.
Yeah.
So you try to isolate them, but still they are together, and there's the risk of nosocomial infection.
Was there concurrent infections at the same time? I remember one of the talks that I went to on this subject several months ago, they talked about the initial suspicion was that it was cholera, and
right.
it wasn't Ebola, which again
right.
characterized by the same loss of fluid, usually through diarrhea. Was there concurrent issues with cholera or other diarrheal illnesses at the same time to confound everything? Or
yeah, I mean, there were definitely confounders. You knew there were because you'd get a patient who had a diarrheal illness and tested negative twice.
Yeah.
And so you knew you had this guy in an Ebola treatment ward, didn't have Ebola, probably had E. coli,
uh-huh.
maybe amoebic dysentery.
Yeah.
But, you know, the goal of the Ebola treatment center is to isolate
mm-hmm.
and rule out or treat
mm-hmm.
Ebola patients or suspected Ebola patients.
Yeah.
And so we weren't able to make those other steps and truly see what's going on in the community, what other diseases are.
Okay.
We could do a malaria test
uh-huh.
and we could do a Ebola PCR.
So okay.
Ebola.
How quickly did it take from the time you tested a patient to know if they had the positive Ebola PCR?
Well, that was probably the really big problem early on was some of these tests were taking 3 or 4 days to come back.
Wow.
So you have to keep patients. And again, I go back to the suspect ward because to me, it's the scariest place in the Ebola treatment center. Later on, it got down to about 24 hours. And, but some patients would need to stay longer because if you recall, even the U.S. healthcare worker, Brantley, he had a negative Ebola test early on in his disease, I think in day 4 of his disease,
mm-hmm.
day 3 of his disease. So, and it only tested positive when they rechecked him. So some of these patients, if they're early on, you have to retest.
And you have to keep them in that.
And you have to keep them in it.
Oh my gosh.
Was
there resistance? Would some patients say, get me out of here or let me go? Or were there mechanisms in place to kind of help keep that group intact, I suppose?
Yeah, I remember one case in particular was a Senegalese driver who was on his way out of the country. He was getting on an airplane out of Freetown. And right at the airport, every time you walk through any gate, anywhere actually in Freetown, they do an infrared temperature scan on
mm-hmm.
you. And he had a fever.
Mm-hmm.
And he got sent to us right as he was about to leave the country and go back home. And he only spoke French. And
uh-huh.
he had almost no one there who could speak French. So. And his lab test didn't come back. It kept getting lost, and it wasn't drawn appropriately, and So he was in the suspect ward for 4 days and tested negative, fortunately. But he was definitely, you know, scared. It was a communication issue too. He didn't know what was going on. And so really all you can tell the people to do is you give them something to some chlorine to wash their hands, and you tell them to stay away from other patients. And, you know, you hope that's enough.
How much space do they have in the suspect ward? I mean, how big is the suspect ward?
I mean, there's room enough to stay isolated.
Yeah, okay.
But, you know, if you have a patient in your same room and you happen to have the bed next to them, well, at night, you're going to go back and you're going to be close to someone.
Yeah,
I remember probably one of the most horrifying things I saw was in the suspect ward going in at night to do some treatment. There was a 9-year-old kid who we almost knew for sure because his family had Ebola and he had all the classic symptoms, massive diarrhea, but we hadn't confirmed him yet. So he was still in the suspect ward. And I just found another patient, a 15-year-old girl, laying on the ground, essentially in a pool of his diarrhea, infectious Ebola. She tested positive, he tested positive. She probably was positive before, but it goes to show you that infection control there is very, very difficult.
It's just, it's hard to wrap the mind at any time, but particularly the Western mind sitting here around something like that. When you're doing your work, obviously you're sense of humanity is going to be challenged in ways that no one could ever anticipate. I can't comprehend what that's like. I've been through medical school. I've been through residency. I treat critically ill patients every day. And that, quite honestly, is still beyond the pale of anything I've encountered. How do you mentally keep yourself focused and keep yourself in a place where you can continue to do the work that you're there to do?
Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah, I had never experienced anything like this. And a lot of it's the quarantine. A lot of it's just the fact and the isolation that you have to, these patients, you can't be in there with them.
Yeah.
These are ICU patients who you can only go in for and help them for maybe 30 minutes every 6 hours or so. And so, yeah, it's extremely difficult. But, you know, mentally it's, again, you've thought about it. You knew this was coming, and you just go in and you do your job, and you try to decompress afterwards.
What was the morale like amongst your teammates? Did you guys work to try to keep each other on point, keep each other sharp?
Yeah, I mean that is so important that the morale stays up, and even simple things like getting 8 hours of sleep a night and having good food and taking breaks and staying hydrated. So you have to go back to the basics. And as a healthcare worker, you have to make sure you are in prime condition to be working there. And if at any point you feel either psychologically or physically limited, you need to pull yourself back. So you need to take a day off. And so that, again, that goes back to safety first. You have to keep yourself healthy. And if you're going to care for other people, if you can't concentrate because you're thinking about something back home, if you can't concentrate because you're hungry or those simple things, those simple needs, you have to address them. Otherwise, you're a risk to not only yourself, but your colleagues and patients.
We're going to break this into a second part because we got to continue this discussion. So Guy, if you don't mind, you'll stay with us and stay tuned for part two of my conversation with Guy Bezek on his experiences dealing with Ebola in Sierra Leone.
Thank you for listening to Explore the Space. Visit us on our website, explorethespaceshow.com, and please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at ETS Show, and you can email Dr. Shapiro by writing to mark@explorethespaceshow.com.